You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of November, 2012, right here on Monocle 24. Good evening from London and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, we'll be in Copenhagen, Jerusalem and Rome, where our Adrian Craddock is at the IHT Luxury Conference. Adrian, what's the buzz around the corridors?
It's all about Africa and its role in the luxury industry. And it's not just about manufacturing, it's also about the growing consumer base in countries like Nigeria and Morocco.
In Jerusalem, senior reporter of Haaretz newspaper, Angel Pfeffer, tells us how the Iron Dome defense system has been working.
Iron Dome is an active defense system which detects missiles very shortly after their launch, tracks their trajectory, and if the impact point is believed to be in a populated area, the system launches an interceptor missile.
And we'll also be talking about sponsorships gone wrong. In this case, a heavy-handed Christmas display in Brussels. Our PR mistress, Emily Smith, has some thoughts on this. Emily, what do you think? I mean, can you back down on something like this?
Yeah, you can't go near Christmas with a sponsorship. Just leave Christmas alone.
Okay, well, we'll have more on that with Emily a little bit later. All that and much more right here on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. And good evening from Studio One here at Midori House on a very chilly evening here in London. But we have Jonathan Wheatley here to warm us up with some news.
Dozens of Lebanese and Palestinian activists gathered today in front of the United Nations headquarters in Beirut to protest against Israeli attacks on Gaza. Nevertheless, Israel has resumed its airstrikes on the Strip following yesterday's attacks, which killed Ahmed Said Khalil al-Jabari, the head of Hamas's military wing. Egypt has officially requested a meeting of the UN Security Council to discuss the situation. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu defended Israel's actions and accused armed groups in Gaza of committing war crimes.
I'm stressing this because it's important to understand one simple point. There is no moral symmetry. There is no moral equivalence between Israel and the terrorist organizations in Gaza. The terrorists are committing a double war crime. They fire at Israeli civilians and they hide behind Palestinian civilians. And by contrast, Israel takes every measure to avoid civilian casualties.
The murder of a female police officer in front of her daughter in Sao Paulo, Brazil's biggest city, has increased pressure on President Dilma Rousseff to halt a drug-related crime wave where dozens of police have died. Marta Umbelina da Silva was opening the garage in her home when two assailants shot her 10 times in the back. More than half of the 95 police murders this year in Sao Paulo have occurred in similar execution-style fashion. Thousands of people rallied outside Ireland's parliament to demand that strict abortion rules be eased after a pregnant Indian woman repeatedly denied a termination died in an Irish hospital. Savita Halappanava died of septicemia a week after miscarrying 17 weeks into her pregnancy. Her repeated requests for a termination were rejected because of the presence of a fetal heartbeat. The Irish Minister for Health is James Riley.
This is a terrible tragedy, and for any woman to die during pregnancy is something that we're all very upset by. I have no knowledge of the full circumstance. I've seen the reports in the paper. I know the HSE are investigating it. I know it'll be referred to the coroner. And beyond that, I don't want to make any statement at this point.
Here, Prime Minister David Cameron is currently chairing a National Security Council meeting ahead of a visit from Syrian opposition leaders to London on Friday. France broke ranks with its Western allies this week by officially recognising Syria's new opposition coalition, saying it would now look at arming rebels battling President Bashar al-Assad's forces. The UK has signalled support for the coalition, but so far has refrained from a formal recognition. Art auctions ended with a big bang as Christie's staged the most successful sale of post-war and contemporary art in history, taking in $412 million, with an Andy Warhol soaring to $43.8 million. Christie's officials, including art specialist Koji Inui, were thrilled after the auction beat its high estimate, with 11 artists' records set.
The market is robust, healthy, objects of great provenance, freshness to the market, and coming with very attractive prices, proven to do very, very well. It's amazing that contemporary art has become a blue chip store of value. It's something that the market is very confident and believes in.
And finally, two dozen pro-nudity activists wearing little but their righteous indignation assembled on the streets of San Francisco City Hall last night to protest a proposed municipal ban on public nakedness. Rally organiser Gypsy Taub disrobed as her fellow activists displayed signs saying nudity is natural. Well, personally, I've always believed that it's best to get it out in the open. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. I have to say that I have been witness to some very strange public scenes of nudity in San Francisco. It is absolutely bizarre that, you know, there are many neighborhoods within San Francisco where you have sort of the odd sort of naturist, I would almost venture to say sort of loony. I mean, I think, you know, it's fine if you want to do it on the beach or in your backyard, etc. But, you know, maybe, you know, not just flip-flops and that's all to pray down the street to get your milk.
Absolutely. Really, you've seen that in San Francisco?
I have seen that in San Francisco. Oh, gosh. And we're going to leave it right there. Okay. It's 2006 in Istanbul, 1806 here in London. It's 1306 if you're listening in Toronto. This is Midori House. We're back in a moment.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24. And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, the numbers are being constantly updated, but over 200 Hamas rockets have already landed in Israel since an Israeli airstrike that killed the commander of the military wing of Hamas. The rocket attacks have been a test for Israel's Iron Dome system. And you might remember that's a story that we covered some years ago when they were developing the system in the magazine. This is the first mobile air defense system that should be able to cover a medium-sized town for short-range missiles. Well, based on this, what can we now say about how Iron Dome has worked? Well, we are joined on the line now from Jerusalem by Anshul Pfeffer. He is a correspondent with the newspaper Haaretz. Hello, Mr. Pfeffer.
Good evening.
So far, we've obviously seen the very high-profile, PR exercise that went into, of course, the attack against the Hamas leader yesterday, and that's from the Israeli Defense Forces. But I'm wondering what is happening in terms of this system that's had a lot of press and attention around the world. How this is going to be something of a game changer as a defensive system against, I mean, not just Hamas rockets, but I mean, you know, any small-scale rockets that would threaten a small urban area. Has the system been deployed so far?
Yeah, the system has been deployed so far. Four batteries have been deployed. They're right now operational all around the Gaza Strip, covering about four urban areas, all within the range of Hamas mid-range rockets. And so far, the system has been quite effective. It's had a success rate of up to 90% interception. But when you talk about a defensive system being a game changer, it's very difficult to assess that because no defense system is perfect, obviously. And you never know if the missile they intercepted was going to cause major harm or it could have fallen without any result.
Tell us in more detail, Mr. Pfeffer, how this system works. Are these batteries rolled out and deployed, or are they already stationed and in position? They've been dug in for some time. So, you know, when obviously things start to heat up, as they have over the last 24, 48 hours, how did the defense forces in Israel respond?
Well, basically, as you mentioned at the beginning of the section, it's a mobile system. It's It can be transported on heavy trucks. It can be set up in a matter of hours in an area where it's needed, according to intelligence or according to events. And the system has three main components. Obviously, there's a missile launcher and a number of launchers per battery. There is a radar system which detects launch of a missile, of an incoming missile, seconds after launch. It tracks the trajectory of the missile, plots where the missile is probably going to fall. Then the third component is a command center, which also has the capability to make an assessment of where, not just of where the missile is going to fall, but whether that area is a populated area which may cause a lot of harm, and therefore a decision is taken of whether to intercept the missile. Then we go back to the launcher, which launches an intercepting missile, which is supposed to actually hit the incoming missile and explode it high up in the sky.
Now, is this all controlled centrally, or is the decision to shoot down or not, is it all controlled by at a battery level, on a local level, or is someone sitting in a bunker somewhere else in Israel calling the shots?
Well, we're talking a very short time span. We could be talking about a missile which is launched and can reach its target in less than a minute. So in many cases, the decision will be taken by an officer sitting in the battery command post, usually a lieutenant or a captain. So in some cases, obviously all these operations have been coordinated by a central Air Force command post. So in some cases, the decision will be taken by a higher up officer. But the plan for the battery is that they have various areas where if it seems that an incoming missile is going to land there, then they must intercept. And other areas which are sparsely or not populated at all, it's okay for the missile to land there. So basically, a lot of the decisions are already preordained.
Mm. What can you tell? You're in Jerusalem at the moment. We've been seeing stories over the last few hours anyway that now Gaza missiles have been fired at Tel Aviv. Have those all been intercepted? What I'm seeing on several sites right now just says fired at Tel Aviv. But in terms of actually hitting targets or causing damage, what do you know so far?
Well, as I mentioned before, the Iron Dome is currently spread around cities and towns closer to the Gaza Strip. Tel Aviv is about 75 kilometers away, and that's not currently covered by the Iron Dome. That's partly an assessment that the chances of missiles hitting Tel Aviv are relatively small, they're hitting cities closer to Gaza, the chances are much larger. And also because of a lack of batteries. These batteries cost about $200 million apiece. They're very new, so far there are only four batteries in existence. So they're being allocated to the areas which are most under threat. Tel Aviv is not one of them. Regarding what actually happened this evening in Tel Aviv, it seems that one or two missiles fell in the sea off the coast of Jaffa, south of Tel Aviv, and another missile seems to have hit a southern suburb of Tel Aviv, but not caused any damage or casualties.
Great. Angel Pfeffer from Haaretz in Jerusalem. Thank you very much for that. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're going to be talking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, right after this.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers, energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick-and-span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero-emission zealots. For a full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
the latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes, and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks, and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
And you're back with Midori House. It is just 16 minutes past 1800 here in London. Just looking at the front cover of the Sydney Morning Herald, just off the back of our story, talking about those rocket attacks and the Iron Dome in Israel, the intercept system. But Sydney Morning Herald, this is the Friday edition of the paper, leads on a social media story. Israel uses social media to push cause. And it shows some of the comments that have been surrounding many of many of the images that have also been put up by Israeli defense forces, and it talks about just over the last 24 hours, over 640,000 people have watched the attack on the Hamas leader Ahmed Saeed al-Jabari, and how it also led with the story eliminated. And that's this is a story which is leading the Friday edition of the Sydney Morning Herald. Before the break, we said that we're going to talk to our correspondent Steve Bloomfield, but he is in a bit of a security tangle as well. At least he's going through an X-ray machine in Copenhagen at the moment. So we will let the authorities do their job at the airport. In the meantime, though, we are going to go just a little bit south of Copenhagen. We're going to go to Amsterdam. This is Fantastic by Wouter Hamel. To see it all, I'm sure we'd have a ball in Namibia or Nepal, but I'd rather keep you in bed. I'd rather keep you in my bed. Oh, yeah. Huh. Get in my bed. And that was Wouter Hamel with the live version performed for us here at Monocle of Fantastic. We now have our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, on the line. He is winging his way back to London, at least almost winging his way back to London. He was up in Haparanda. He is now at Copenhagen Airport. He's about to board his flight, I believe, back to Heathrow. Might be somewhere else. Hopefully it's Heathrow. Steve, good evening.
Good evening, Tyler. It is Heathrow, yes, and I made it through security. No problems.
Good. Well, I'm glad that SAS is still in business for the moment, at least if that's who you're flying anyway.
Yes, I am indeed. It was slightly disconcerting, though, getting on an SAS plane and the gentleman next to you reading a newspaper where the headline is SAS crisis. But yeah, it all seems to be going fine so far.
Okay, so I'm just looking here. A variety of very, very important topics were covered by the Arctic Council up in Haparanda. First, set the scene for us. The Arctic Council is not permanently headquartered in Haparanda. They chose to. Is it a rotating event that moves around the Arctic Circle?
Yes, basically. So there are eight countries in the Arctic Council. Sweden currently hold the chairmanship of it. And so over the course of 2 years, they've had a variety of different meetings and summits, the most recent of which was this week in Haparanda, which is about 100 kilometres just south of where the Arctic Circle starts. And then they're going to have their final meeting in May with all the foreign ministers, and that's in a town called Kiruna, which is right inside the Arctic Circle in northern Sweden.
And so all eight countries, what scale of delegation are you talking about? Is this dozens of people, or is it a cast of hundreds?
For this meeting, it was about 100 or so different delegates, not just from the eight countries, those eight being America, Russia, Iceland, Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Finland, and I'm missing one, Canada. There we are.
Missing one. How dare you?
So there's those, but then there's also some observers as well. Some of those, like Great Britain, that have obviously a great deal of experience and history when it comes to the Arctic. Others, like Spain and Poland, where they perhaps don't have so much history, but they're certainly aware of the
Snow.
Importance of the Arctic and want to be involved.
Mm. And then on the observer side as well, if you think of. Of course, indigenous people to the regions, to those who don't have, of course, nation status. So do you have Sami representation? Do you have representation from Inuit communities as well?
You do, yes. So, well, it's quite interesting at the seating arrangement. You've got four sides to this table, and you've got the secretariat at the head. Then down the left-hand side, you have all the you have half of the member states. Down the right-hand side, you've got another half of the member states, and then you've got the Inuit communities, the Sami communities, the World Wildlife Fund as well. And the observers all sort of at the head, so they're all involved and all get to speak sort of during the discussions.
And are there curious question? But is there an official working language or three or four working languages? I mean, there's always sort of a key issue when you have nations coming together around such a table.
There are there are two working languages. Working languages, English and Russian. But English is the only one that's really spoken. I think one Russian delegate was wearing a headset throughout most of the talks. But other than that, everyone was dealing with English. Although occasionally you do get a Nordic member or two discussing things with each other in Danish or Norwegian while an American stands nearby and can't understand what's going on.
Now, of course, there are some key headline topics that we know about. Melting polar ice cap, I would imagine, various geopolitical issues about whose ships are going to be going through the Northwest Passage, et cetera, et cetera. Were those the main talking points, or were there perhaps some more curious or surprising areas that that nations wanted to jump into?
Well, climate change is the key theme, but then out of that, there are many different issues. So, for example, you mentioned the Northwest Passage, there's also the Northern Sea Route north of Russia, which has now been sort of starting to gradually open up. And so the issues to deal with that are search and rescue issues. So they've struck a deal recently on search and rescue, on cooperation. And the key thing they're working on at the moment that the Swedes are very keen to get wrapped up in time for May is some sort of legally binding deal between all eight countries about preventing oil spills. So what sort of regulations do you have for ships that are going through both the Northern Sea the Northern Sea Route, and also if they do eventually drill for oil around Greenland, off the coast of Greenland as well, and that's a key thing, because a number of people raise this issue of, you know, if we have an oil spill up there, it's potentially worse than Deepwater Horizon, because it's so hard to actually get down to through the ice to clean it up.
Mm. Tell me, when you look at all of those issues combined, I'm wondering then if you then focus on indigenous populations and of course so much of the dialogue often is about issues concerning wildlife, etc. Do the ptarmigans in the far north of Canada or do walruses have a seat at the table as well?
It's interesting. You get very different views.
Don't be rude about the Russian delegates either.
You get very different views on issues of wildlife. I think the Canadians are slightly concerned at how the rest of the world views the way they've dealt with seals in the past. And there's obviously issues over wildlife in Greenland as well. It's a part of the world that, although it's it's enormous. It's 10 times the size of India. It has just 56,700 people, and I think there's a feeling amongst some that some of those people that complain about what happens in Greenland are quite happy to drink their cafe lattes in Copenhagen or Oslo or Stockholm, but don't want to see people in Greenland actually having improved lives. So it's interesting seeing all these things come out. And what's particularly interesting is that they're very keen on consensus at the Arctic Council. So when you've got a group that has both Russia and the US on, an international group like this, where you have to agree, it's kind of actually quite heartwarming to see that there are some international institutions that still seem to be working.
Hmm. Well, you make it all sound incredibly cozy. Just before we go, I know you're 100K south of the Arctic Circle. Did you spot any interesting wildlife?
We did. Well, we thought since we're only 100 kilometres south, we can't really come home without making a trip to the Arctic Circle. So we got up a little bit earlier this morning, drove north up to Pole Circle, the border of the polar circle, and while there saw a bunch of reindeer, including one beautiful white reindeer who, when all the others walked away from us, this one turned and walked to us. I was quite tempted to see if we could pack it up and bring it back to Midori House for the Christmas fair, but it kind of seemed quite happy where it was. So I've got photographic evidence, and I'm afraid for now that'll have to do.
Right, and probably booties and sausages as well. Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, we look forward to seeing you back at base tomorrow. You're listening to Midori House. It's almost the bottom of the hour. News headlines right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monaco 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And it's exactly 18:30 here in Studio One at Midori House, which means it's time for Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. Israel has resumed its airstrikes on the Gaza Strip following yesterday's attacks, which killed Ahmed Said Khalil al-Jabari, the head of Hamas's military wing. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu defended Israel's actions and actually accused armed groups in Gaza of committing war crimes. The murder of a female police officer in front of her daughter in Sao Paulo, Brazil's biggest city, has increased pressure on President Dilma Rousseff to halt a drug-related crime wave, which has killed nearly 100 police officers so far this year alone. Thousands of people rallied outside Ireland's parliament to demand that strict abortion rules be eased after a pregnant Indian woman repeatedly denied a termination died in a Dublin hospital. Here, Prime Minister David Cameron is currently chairing a National Security Council meeting ahead of a visit from the Syrian opposition leaders to London on Friday. France broke ranks with its Western allies this week by officially recognising that opposition coalition, saying it would now look to actually arming the rebels battling President Bashar al-Assad's forces. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. We're going to be continuing our programme the next 29 minutes with a new project aimed at creating more cooperation between Middle Eastern and Western business leaders right after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle 24.
From London.
London, Caracas.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
18:32 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tyler Boulay. Well, one of the most influential entrepreneurs in Africa, Egyptian businessman Shafiq Gabber, has a new project. He wants to bring together young leaders from Middle Eastern and Western countries for discussions and for networking. The exchange program is called East-West, the Art of Dialogue. And to discuss this further, I'm joined in the studio by journalist and Middle Eastern cultural expert Ben East, who's been speaking to Shafiq Gabber. Welcome.
Hello.
Now, I have to ask, hopefully it's not a rude question, but do we need more dialogue programs? And you're going to say now more than ever.
Well, I think it's necessary. It certainly was necessary today, because what they were talking about right at the very start, Tony Blair was there. and they were talking about what was happening in Israel and the Gaza Strip. And certainly Tony Blair was saying, we need to kind of de-escalate and talk about and talk about these issues in a kind of non-aggressive way.
Now, this gathering of course, business forces from the West and then also the region, is it an investor conference? Is it what is the format like? Because I mean, oftentimes you look at the pages of the FT or the Wall Street Journal, you see lots of conferences, lots of big headline sponsors. Is it an event like any of those, or does it have a different spin than many of these investor style networking conferences?
Well, really, it's a cultural angle to it. Really, Shafiq is a guy who is really interested in the Orientalists, the painters from the 19th century, and they've traditionally been seen as very interesting painters, but also kind of culturally a bit dodgy because of kind of the cultural sort of the way that things go in that sort of area. And I think really what he's trying to do is say we can learn things from these Orientalists, essentially, because they went out there and they talked and they integrated into that society, and they came back and showed the West what was available, what was there.
I mean, as you said, obviously, Tony Blair was picking up on the themes that, of course, we were also talking about at the top of this program and in the bulletin that you just heard. So, of course, playing on very current events. Those aside, what are the main cultural issues that are also part of the lineup at the conference?
Well, the cultural issue, what they're trying to do is set up this exchange program, essentially. So what they want to do is get young business leaders together and from the Middle East and from the West together in one room for 2 weeks in America and then 2 weeks in Cairo. And the idea is that by talking to each other, they will then be able, in some way, to understand each other a bit more. It's not about what Shafiq says. What he really wants to get past is this idea of people just emailing each other, not really understanding each other. It's really about a way in which business leaders, and it's not just business leaders, actually, it's people from science and arts and everything, can get together, and then they will understand each other. And therefore, in the future, it sounds naive, I know, but in the future, maybe there will be this situation whereby that people will understand each other more.
I mean, it's interesting that you talk about getting people from the Middle East or North Africa, over to the United States, and then vice versa, getting them to Egypt, particularly after a year when we've been hearing so much about the Arab Spring, and that the Arab Spring was in so many ways facilitated by social media, and this was, of course, a digital revolution. But this goes really the completely different different direction. It's about getting people across from each other in a room, and sounds like looking each other in the eye, but not over Skype.
Exactly. That was the exact things that were mentioned, actually. There were people at the conference talking about how Twitter, for example, was very, very important. And there were other people in the conference saying it's just noise. And actually what we need to do is be thinking about how we can actually talk to each other properly. And what they're going to do is get 8 Egyptians, 2 Bahrainis, 8 Americans and 2 British people together. And their hope really is that from that there can be some sort of, I don't know, they want to try and work on projects really together, and then they're going to kind of display them at a future conference as well.
So do you think that from the perspective of Shafiq Gabra, does he want to eventually see the construction of, a permanent center where this dialogue lives on a nice avenue in Washington and one in Cairo? Is that where this goes and I guess obviously evolves eventually into a permanent home or becomes sort of the preeminent place for this East-West dialogue? I mean, what do you think is the ultimate ambition for this?
Well, I asked him about that actually, and the ultimate ambition is for him, in a weird way, not to be involved at all. He is sort of setting it off, and what he wants is people, global institutions, Yale, people, universities in the UK too, think tanks, governments, NGOs, to all kind of get together and kind of take it on, if you see what I mean.
Now, was this by invitation event? Because obviously these things tend to work well when you're able to curate the room a little bit. So when you looked at the assembled cast and crowd, who was there?
Well, there were people from, there were lots of Shafiq's business associates from across the world, really. There were politicians, there were lots of journalists too. It was an invited event, that's true. And I did get the sense that there was a sort of elephant in the room, in that you really did think to yourself, okay, this is great. This is great that we're kind of promoting dialogue, but actually, are we going to get anywhere with it? Mm. And that was the kind of thing that was never really, I don't think, ever really kind of discussed in a way that I was happy with.
Right. Okay. I mean, you're in studio now, so do you think there's also a lot of people who are probably scratching their heads as we're early evening in London, and people who've left, or I mean, maybe they're at some wonderful dinner at the moment. Yeah, but I guess that is always the thing before you trek off back to your hotel room or get on the plane when you leave these events. You sort of wonder what type of resolution and what steps. Now, obviously, you said something should take place in Egypt, though something will take place in the United States as well. But did someone wrap it all up and tie a tidy bow at the end of it?
Not really. I think really what it is, it's the beginning point of a process which Mr. Gabo hopes in the end will lead to a better world. And in some respects, I mean, what was quite interesting is that there were people there from all walks of life. There were people there from the military too. And one guy said, essentially, you know, it's better that this is being attempted than not at all. And, you know, why not be possibly naive? Why not say that by getting young people together that maybe things can go better, you know?
Absolutely. Ben East, Middle East cultural expert and also journalist on the Shafiq Gabor Initiative here in London. Thanks very much for that. It is 18:39 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
The Entrepreneurs is a show about inspiring startups, innovative business models, and smart CEOs. It's about good ideas and the people with the business acumen to make them into the brands of tomorrow.
Character, your vision, your courage, all these are necessary to become a leader.
On the latest episode, we talk stationery, from a letterpress in Cape Town to the only pencil factory in Portugal. We meet a company giving new vim to the greeting cards industry and profile the scribblers and the envelope pushers.
I know for myself, at least, and I'm sure it goes for many out there, that I would rather a card with nice words over a present.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
As more and more governments demand cuts in public spending, design and healthcare is viewed more often than not as an unaffordable luxury. But design-savvy Denmark, not surprisingly, recognises the curative potential of good design.
If you should look at the outcome for the patients, you should really think about the design, about the inclusion of nature, about the inclusion of organic materials, because it really lifts the patients.
Monocle Films drops in on a hospice that feels more like a home. Broadcasting now on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House. You're in Studio One with me, Tyler Brulé. Well, we're going to head off to Rome right now, where our associate business editor, Adrian Craddock, is covering the IHT Luxury Conference. You might recall yesterday I was chatting to the IHT's fashion editor, Susie Menkes. She also told me off as well for being somewhat out of touch. Anyway, our Adrian Craddock there is there to, of course, connect us to all that is happening at the conference this year. Good evening, buonasera, Mr. Craddock. How are you?
Good evening, Tyler. How are you going?
Good. Very well. When we were chatting to Susie yesterday, she said that, you know, much of the focus is on looking across the Mediterranean and really almost was referencing, of course, you know, the Holy Roman Empire and how these were very fertile lands for the Roman Empire. This was, you know, an incredibly important trading region for them, and also talked about the opportunities, not so much that people are going to get rich immediately in Africa, but how there is so much scope to, of course, look at manufacturing, being able to build a base, within many African economies. Is that what you've heard and seen so far on stage today?
Well, definitely. I mean, the title of the conference is The Promise of Africa and the Power of the Mediterranean. And I think the thing that keeps being hammered home is the thing that links those two is a dedication to craftsmanship. And the big push here is a belief that Africa is a big opportunity when it comes to manufacturing. You know, brands like Fendi and Vivienne Westwood have already really invested in getting some of their products made in Africa. So, I mean, it's kind of a contentious issue in some ways. I mean, I spoke with a senior executive at Valentino about this, about whether he would ever consider getting some of his products manufactured on the African continent. And he kind of shrunk away and was a little bit hesitant. So, I mean, I think there's
We'll take that as a no.
Well, I mean, he was hesitant, I'll put it that way.
Okay. Tell us, it's quite, as ever, the IHG does a very good job of bringing together, not just, great audience, but also Susie's very good at drawing great people up on stage with her. What were some of the highlights, some of the better things that you saw and heard today?
Well, I mean, the lineup has been absolutely outstanding. I mean, really, the premier names in the luxury industry. We have Donatella Versace, Vivienne Westwood, Kim Jones from Louis Vuitton, Jean-Paul Gaultier. Probably the highlight so far has been Vivienne Westwood. I mean, she really told it how she saw it, in the sense that, everyone was talking a lot throughout the conference about creating, a middle-class consumer base in Africa. And I think she kind of took exception to that. She talked a lot about how, many labels are overlooking the deeper issues in Africa, fixing political instability, fixing environmental devastation and corruption. So it was quite a scene to see her get up at the podium and really rattle that off. The other thing that really struck me was Olu, he's a Nigerian designer. He's really, really a fantastic designer. He's famous for when Obama was re-elected just recently, Michelle Obama was wearing one of his beautiful coats. He kind of took exception as well on stage in some ways to this idea of, this quite dated idea of Africa as a really kind of safari, wild nation. He really kind of was a bit annoyed, I guess, at this idea that urban Africa, which is so dynamic and so interesting, is kind of overlooked in this kind of discussion.
I mean, yeah, and particularly, of course, when you think of Nigeria, a market, if you spend any time in Paris or London or elsewhere, where you see no shortage of very wealthy men and women from Lagos, carrying around a lot of products from, the chief marketing officers and CEOs are sitting in the audience. I mean, it's a very important market, maybe not in Lagos, but certainly Nigerians traveling abroad who are buying a lot of Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Bottega Veneta, etc.
Definitely. I mean, there was a stat reeled off today where the middle class in Africa is now around 300 million strong, with a combined spending power of 2.2 trillion. So it's no surprise, really, that this region has been the focus of the conference, because there's definitely a massive business opportunity to be had here.
How much focus has been given to China? This is a theme that we cover in the magazine constantly. If we think back to our senior editor Sophie Grove's story about the African Union's new headquarters in Addis Ababa, and of course the power of China in creating that, and obviously we've been looking at the role of China, in Angola, in Mozambique. Has that been a topic? Because whenever we talk about luxury, we have to talk about the Chinese market, but also, China, as we know, is very active and quite often in very questionable ways, on the African continent.
It's a very complex debate, well, at least it has been today, because, I mean, I just mentioned there the growing middle class, and a lot of that is attributed in part to the investment that China has given. I mean, they're really pouring billions into infrastructure, and that is filtering down to the African middle class. But at the same time, yes, there have been questions about, whether their ethics are up to standard and whether that will kind of affect manufacturing in particular. Also, there's a debate about, who needs who more. Obviously, China benefits greatly from the natural resources that come out of Africa, but Africa as well kind of has benefited, as I just mentioned. So I don't know, it's still, one gentleman was asked, you know, whether, you know, it is a good thing. And on the panel, he just kind of said, it's too early to tell. We'll find out because, I mean, this still really is a fresh story on the continent.
Mm. I mean, let's just boil this down for a second, though. Do you think that if I'm the owner or an investor in a major European brand and I'm sitting in that audience, do you think ultimately what I want to walk away from that conference with is maybe a hope that over the next 36 months I can build into my business plan that, you know, in fact, I can move part of my manufacturing out of Italy. Some of the things that I was perhaps making in Eastern Europe or in Asia, I can now have them made in Kenya. I can now have these things made in Tanzania. I can certainly save on my my shipping costs, the fuel costs of aircraft and ships. Trudging all the way around Southeast Asia to get up to the markets of Europe and North America, and therefore I see that I've got this fantastic base much closer to home. Do you think that is part of it? Because I was asking Susie, is this about manufacturing or is this about the power of this marketplace, these 300 million that you refer to?
I think that it's perhaps part of that. I mean, obviously, manufacturing is a lot cheaper in a country like Africa. I think for CEOs with a very moral bone in their body, this is the opportunity because the big theme that was pushed was that this isn't just a business opportunity to be had to make profits, and that was made very clear that this was a very profitable situation that could be had. It's also about investing in a country that has had a lot of turmoil. At the same time, everyone's very quick at this conference to remind you that it's not charity, it's about work. It's about providing work and providing a very sustainable working culture within the African continent and really just pushing that along.
Adrian, we'll look forward to checking in with you on day two of the IHT's luxury conference in Rome tomorrow. That was our associate business editor, Adrian Craddock, in Rome. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment. Here in Studio One. Actually, not just 1850 in Studio One. I think it's 1850, perhaps all over the United Kingdom right now, and probably Portugal too. We are going to have a song right now. This is Jade with Everybody. And that was Jade with Everybody here on Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time to jump across the channel right now over to Brussels, where a battle is brewing around a rather peculiar Christmas tree that will soon come to light. While the city's historic market square has long been home to traditional fir trees at Christmas time, this year's tree won't be much of one at all. Sponsored by Belgian energy firm Electrabel, this year's electronic tree is made up of digital screens and panels, and as many locals calling foul. With residents bemoaning an abandonment of tradition, we too are left wondering if Brussels has gone all a bit too Times Square with this year's tree. Well, for a look into this and a bit of perspective on how well-meaning sponsorships often manage to go very, very wrong, we're joined in the studio by our Adam Thompson, copywriter at our sister company, Wink Creative, and our Emily Smith, who looks after PR communications events here.
Firefighting.
She's got her extinguisher with her. Adam, I wanted to start with you. It's a classic story right now where you see many cities' budgets are squeezed. Many people sort of asking in this era of also political correctness, would you just spend money at Christmas time? And you know, that of course raises you know many issues at City Hall as well. So then you turn to the private sector and perhaps a well-meaning electric company like this, and they say, well, look, if we're going to do it, we want to promote what we do. So you're going to get backlit screens and not fir trees.
Indeed. I think it's quite an unusual move, especially seemingly against the kind of traditions of the local population, which is, obviously they're up in arms about it. But you look at it, and as you say, where budgets are squeezed, you need to make concessions. And so I can understand how it's happened. I think the sponsorship that's happening down the road from here at Regent Street with Marmite doing the London Lights is quite unusual, but quite interesting, perhaps quite perplexing, though, to foreign tourists. So I think you really have to be careful about who you're partnering with and making sure that it fits and works for the occasion.
I mean, Em, you like a bit of Marmite, but being a good Aussie, you probably like Vegemite more. So you
Vegemite's a clear winner, but I still don't think Vegemite should own Christmas. I can't imagine how they pass this on the board. I just think, in Brussels, I think you can celebrate Christmas and you can use brands to celebrate Christmas, but you can't use brands to be Christmas.
Right.
And how are they ever going to think people are going to want to sort of warm their hands around a massive group of plasmas?
Right.
Like what?
What a concept for upcoming Christmas market that we're
you're
having.
You're drinking your eggnog and you're sort of watching a projection of a tree on a screen.
I want to come back to you in a second as to how a company like Electrabel, which is kind of an interesting name because it sounds kind of cute and cozy, sort of like Tinkerbell with electricity.
Yeah, and it sounds
nice. But how they recover from it. But, I mean, Adam, to you first, I mean, you know, what would you do? Do you sort of say, look, you know, you de-brand it and everything else and you try to say, we're going to make the best of this year, but, you know, next year trees are back? Or do you just say, look, just write them a check and be done with it and just go by association?
I think you probably stick with, stick to your guns in this and perhaps it's a case of learning from this and next year coming back stronger and giving them what they want in a bigger way, perhaps more innovative as well. It looks like an atrocious kind of idea to me. So yes.
Em, quickly, a PR extinguisher at Christmas time. What would you do if you had to advise a CEO? What would you do?
Of Electrabel?
Yeah.
I'd be down there handing out free eggnog with Electrabel cups. I'd be giving gifts. I would almost be putting a massive tree somewhere else, like the best damn tree you can find, and buy it and give it, put it somewhere else in Brussels. I think it's a shocker.
PR 101, you heard it here first. We're going to have to leave it there. That is all for this edition of Midori House. In 3 hours' time at 2200, here in London, Andrew Muller and Tom Burgess-Watson, just over from Paris, will be here with The Monocle Daily. I'm going to be back tomorrow with Midori House. Adam, Em, you can join me if you want. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a good evening. Goodbye from London.